I've done a little bit of writing. Writing is tough. We've got one of the best techno, no, maybe the best techno thriller writer in the world. He's Dale Brown. He's with us tonight. Some of the books I've enjoyed: Flight of the Old Dog, first one, I loved it. Air Battle Force, Strike Force, Dreamland. That's right. He wrote about Dream, writes a whole lot about Dreamland, actually. Armageddon, The Art of War, Edge of Battle, Storming Heaven. I could go on about 19 of them, actually. So if you have any questions for Dale Brown, anything he's said tonight or about writing, and we're going to talk for a few moments in a moment about writing, and then we're going to open the phone lines. Any questions at all? Those are the portal numbers. So come on in. The water's warm. We'll be right back. Dale, I've been doing radio for well in excess of 20 years. I know you've been writing for more than 20 years. Are you still having fun?
It is. I'm the luckiest guy in the world to be able to do what I do. There's two things that I've always wanted to do in my life is fly and write, and I've been lucky enough to do both for a living. Now it's absolutely the greatest thing in the world, and one of the best things I love doing is encouraging would-be writers to get published. And I love doing it. I love when so when people who think they can't do it, who believe that it's just too daunting, they walk into a bookstore and they see thousands of books out there, and they think that they can't do it because everybody has taken the market. People have just exhausted all the avenues for getting published. What I really love doing is to convince people who are good writers, who are committed to the craft, to actually sit down and actually finish that manuscript, finish that story that they've got in their heads.
Well, it is tough. I mean, if you're Dale Brown, oh, no problem getting published there. They're screaming for you. But a first-time author, it is daunting, Dale. So.
Well, we're all first-time authors. I was a first-time author. Yeah, that was a long time ago, but everybody is a first-time author. You have to have the personal commitment to be able to. I mean, it is tough in the fact that to write 500 or 600 pages,
Yes.
that's a major commitment of your time, of your mental energy, of your physical energy to actually do it. There's no doubt about that, but if you're committed to the craft, if you have a story, if you're committed to the story that's rattling around in your head, you owe it to yourself, and you owe it to the, seriously, you owe it to the rest of the world to get that book out there and to get it in writing and to get it into the hands of somebody who can get it published for you.
Dale, I used to do 5-hour radio programs, and then I would sit down for 2 to 3 hours every day after a 5-hour show and write. What is your routine like? What kind of discipline do you have? Or do you just let it sort of, really crank out one day and then just ignore another day when you don't feel it, or what?
You have to let it flow, and I don't mean to be so metaphysical about it, but you have to be aware you have a story in your head. You have to be ready to let the story out, to get it on paper, to get it on the computer, whatever you use. You have to be in a position when the story gels in your head, you have to get it down. And that for me, that means sitting down at the computer, sitting down at the desk with the computer on, with the word processor fired up, and whether or not you actually do any pages or not, that's almost immaterial. I always call it butt glue. You have to be sitting here. You have to be at the desk. You have to be ready to go. Whether or not you do one page, or you do 10 pages, or you do 15 pages, that's really immaterial. When the story gels in your head, when it's ready to go, mm-hmm. when you've resolved the conflicts in your head, you have to be ready to go. And there's a commitment, there's a personal commitment, there's a time commitment that you have to be ready to invest in. And that's how you become a writer. I'm not an English major. I don't think I've ever taken any sort of creating writing class. I never belonged to any writers groups. I did after I became published. I mentor people all the time, but I don't belong to any writers groups. You have a story in your head that needs to come out. You have to have the discipline and the commitment to yourself and to your readers, to your audience, to actually get that story out.
And I'm sure you've noticed many days when it just pours out of you and it's so easy, and then other days where it's real serious work to try to get anything meaningful out.
Absolutely. And that's when you have to realize, just like anything else in your life, if you're into gardening or if you're into flying or if you're into boating, you know, or golf, you know, I played 9 holes tonight before I came on the show. I mean, other than writing, I think golf is one of the most frustrating activities you can have. You have to be committed to it. You have to enjoy the idea of just going out and you know, up here in Lake Tahoe, we have the most beautiful golf courses in the world. You have to be able to see and appreciate the beauty around you. That's how you let the enjoyment in life come through. If you focus on how lousy your game is, you focus on the last bad shot, you focus on the negative stuff, you're never going to make it. You could be in the best situation. You could have all the money in the world. You could have all the greatest ideas in the world. But if you focus on the negative stuff, if you allow the negative stuff to control your life and to regulate what your life and your attitude is,
right,
you're going to fail.
You could be in Los Angeles, San Fran, or New York, but you're in Tahoe. What is it about Tahoe you like?
It's a small town. It doesn't seem like a small town during the holidays or during ski season, but for most of the year, it's very quiet. We're up in the mountains. We're at 6,300 feet. We're in the middle of nowhere, you know, relatively speaking. We're 4 miles from, or 4 hours driving time from San Francisco, 2 hours to Sacramento. We're really in the middle of nowhere, but it's a small town atmosphere. It's a great place to raise kids. I have a 10-year-old son. It's a great place to be. It's a quiet place most of the time of the year. Do we have a busy season? We have but you know, physically it's beautiful. We have mountains, we have the lake, we have the deserts. It's absolutely gorgeous out here. It allows you the opportunity to not deal with external distractions like
right.
traffic and population and noise and things like that. If you need those things in your life to energize your attitude and to feel like you're plugged into the world, then probably Lake Tahoe is not the place for you. but my world, what I get plugged into, is between my ears. It's in my head, and I could really live anywhere in the world. Lake Tahoe right now just is the perfect place for me.
Got it.
Because it's quiet and allows me to focus on my work and into fostering imagination, which is what I need, which is what my craft desires.
All right, away we go. A lot of people want to talk to you. I've got a screen full of people here. Bruce, in California, you're on the air with Dale Brown. Hi.
Yes, sir. Hello.
Hey, Bruce. How you doing?
Yes, I'm Bruce from Turlock, Salinas, California. First, Art, congratulations to you and yours.
Thank you.
Second, he's going to have a little bit of trouble golfing in 30 foot of snow.
okay. We had snow just 3 weeks ago. We had 2 inches of snow up here. Crazy.
Border security. How come in 72 they were suggesting a inland waterway between San Diego to Corpus Christi? This is a extension that exists from Corpus Christi to Jacksonville, Florida. How come nobody's considering this?
I haven't heard of that plan itself. That's a monstrous project, you know. Mm-hmm. But monstrous projects have been done before. I lived back in Western New York. We used to take vacations all the time down the Erie Canal, which was a monstrous project back when it was first conceived back then. So it's doable, but as far as border security is concerned, you think about the workers that would be necessary to do a project like that, or even a project a tenth of that size. But I mean, you're not going to find that number of workers in the United States. It's an issue that we need to deal with, but I think we can deal with it.
Well, as you pointed out, Dale, no matter what you've got, if it's a fence or if it's a waterway or whatever, you still need boots on the ground.
Absolutely, absolutely. You can have the greatest sensors in Edge of Battle. I describe the sensors that we have right now and the sensors that we will have available in the next 2 to 5 years or so that are just mind-boggling. But you can have the greatest sensors in the world. To when those sensors actually pick up somebody, you need to have somebody that will apprehend the people that the sensors have detected. And that means boots on the ground. The only effective border security method that has been proven over the years is actual physical presence on the border.
All right. Bob in California, west of the Rockies, you're on with Dale Brown. Hi.
Mr. Bell, it's a pleasure to speak to you again, sir.
Thank you.
This is Bob from Fresno.
Hey, Bob. How's it going?
Just fine, Mr. Brown. Mr. Bell, I have a quick statement to make to Mr. Brown with a small question, if I
mm-hmm.
may.
Mm-hmm.
But first, if I may, I'd like to say about you, Mr. Bell, I've listened to you since the very beginning on radio, talked to you through the years. And I want to say this because millions of people would probably like to say the same thing. With your ability to articulate, your ability to be what you are, every guest says the same thing, how you hit the nail on the head. Your abilities are so incredible.
Thank you.
But I'm saying this because whatever you write in the future, millions of us will read, expressing yourself that long after you retire, how much we're going to enjoy in future generations of all that you write about. So please consider writing even more.
Perhaps so, but the real writer is right here, Dale.
All right.
So go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Brown, before I ask you the question and a quick statement first, I want to say run for office. I'll vote for you.
Thanks very much. I'm not going to run for office. You know,
I agree with you.
I would love to advise. I would love to give my opinions, but I do that in the pages of my book.
Well, my quick statement is that about the border security. I just wanted to see if you want to address this at all, because you mentioned briefly about it earlier, and that is, our friends to the south that want a better life for their families, for their children.
Sure.
They're not just fruit pickers. They're engineers. They're scientists. There are many people just like us up here. And there has to be a way to distinguish between these good people and the treatment we show them, the respect we show them versus terrorism. Why can't there be discussions and plans for a terrorist unit that's specially trained to work with border officials and looking for terrorism and being able to tell the difference between proper treatment and respect for those wanting a better life versus the terrorists? And that was the statement, if you want to address. But my question for you about your book, for people that don't have time to always read books, can you give us one good reason why patriots, loyal Americans like myself, need to read the book? And thank you very much for this evening.
Well, I'm not sure which book. He's written 19, I think, but Dale?
Yeah, thanks very much, Bob. I think that's exactly what Edge of Battle deals with. It's not exactly what the present of the border security and illegal immigration problem is. It's the future of what the problem is. What would we be willing to do if the situation worsened, if the political dynamics were confused, if people didn't know what to do, and the military stepped forward and suggested solutions to the problem, what situations would be created if you actually had a president, if you had a Congress that committed to actually putting military forces on the border to stop terrorists, and then to stop illegal immigrants? What all the political ramifications would be, all the economic ramifications, what the social economic ramifications would be? You can't deal with one aspect of the problem just with the military aspect of it. You have to. So there was one thing that I ran to very quickly with Edge of Battle is that you talk to the military folks about what you can do for border security, and the military has a plan, and they have forces, and they have units, and they have systems ready to go to address the problem. But then you run into other problems. You run into other difficulties that also have to be addressed. You can't deal with the military problem and not deal with the social problems, economic problems, historical problems. That was one of the main things that I ran into, that the Southwest United States is historically considered parts of Mexico. That was northwestern Mexico. And there are a lot of people in Mexico that still consider Arizona, New Mexico, California as part of Mexico.
Well, Dale, I hope we don't have to wait until one of our cities blows up until we implement such a plan.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You have to, that's the problem. That's the immediate concern that the military and the government is faced with. But especially after 9/11, all the rules have changed. All the dynamics, all the things that the writers were afraid to address, that we would never write about years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we would never consider writing a scene where 3,000 innocent people would be killed in one scene. If you're talking about a military force, a military engagement, 3,000 losses is not that great. But if you're talking about 3,000 innocent civilians, that's completely different. A lot of authors wouldn't, including me, wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. After 9/11, we have to consider all that,
exactly,
all that stuff, and we have to address it every day.
All right, Dale, hold tight. Bottom of the hour already. Time is really flying. Dale Brown is my guest. He is such a prolific and such a very good author. When he writes a new book, I grab it right up. We'll be right back. By the way, for those who have asked, the Kingdom of Nye, that's NYE, is actually Nye County. Nye County, that's where I am, an area just over the hill, and I mean literally just over the hill from Area 51. That some call dreamland. My guest is Dale Brown, and he'll be right back. Dale, other than Strike Force, which I'm not going to allow you to name, what is your favorite book?
My favorite book? Boy, that's a good question. I have to tell you that my third book was Day of the Cheetah. When I wrote Day of the Cheetah, that was the third book of a three-book contract, the first three-book contract. Mm-hmm. That included Flight of the Old Dog and Silver Tower. Well, I was so convinced for some reason, and this is the mentality of a first-time author. I was so convinced that nobody would ever buy the third book, even though Flight of the Old Dog did okay as a hardback, did much better as a paperback. Silver Tower did so-so as a hardback also. But I wasn't convinced that I would ever make it as an author. So when I was doing the third book, I thought, you know, this is the last novel I'm ever going to write. So I might as well just pull out all the stops, and I was going to write the novel that was just would shock everybody. And that's what I did. I wrote a book. It was set about 8 years after Flight of the Old Dog. Everybody had aged a little bit, but I wanted to write a novel where I would put up every possible obstacle to success for Patrick McClanahan. I was going to write the ultimate conflict story where everything bad that was possible was going to happen to the hero and see him dig himself out of it. And I crashed the Old Dog, killed off most of the crew members, destroyed Dreamland, having FBI investigations and all this, Pentagon, the wrath of the Pentagon, was coming down on all the heroes in the story. And it was the most outrageous book because I knew, or at least I thought that all my heroes, the old saying was if you're going to elevate your heroes, you have to destroy them. You have to be willing to destroy your heroes. You have to be able to kill all your darlings.
You've done a lot of that.
And that's what I did with Day of the Cheetah. And I think pouring your emotions into that story really elevated it. And I think that's my ultimate favorite book because I thought that was going to be the last one, and I wanted to put all of my energy and all my emotions into that book.
And yet you picked yourself up and went on. All right.
Well, halfway through that book, I got another three-book contract, and I knew after that I was going to make it as a writer. So it still turned out to be a very successful book, made it to us number four on the bestseller list, was on the bestseller list for 8 weeks, but that's the thing. That's the commitment that authors have to be willing to do. You have to have an emotional attachment to the story that you're writing, and you have to be willing to put that emotion, and you have to put a piece of yourself into your writing. And those are the guys who are going to make it successful. Those are the guys who are going to make it as authors, not just writing a story, not just picking scenes and picking characters and picking, you know, plots and technology, but actually putting a piece of yourself into your writing. Those are the guys who are going to make it. And that's what editors and publishers and agents in New York City are looking for. They've seen all the stories. The old saying is that there's only seven original ideas and everything else is a spin-off of the original seven ideas. But what editors and publishers and agents are looking for is the personal attachment. When you write a story, when you come up with an idea, you have to put a piece of yourself into that writing.
And it's the emotional investment, and you know it when you read it. Michael in Virginia, you're on the air with Dale Brown.
Hi, yes, calling you from Norfolk tonight, Dale, and I appreciate your speaking up for the American military the way you have tonight on this program.
Thank you.
And connecting that with your last comment about putting yourself into the picture and connecting emotionally, you talked about us being in a war against radical Islam.
Yes.
And the problem that I see with your presentation from the standpoint of the average listener is that it sounded too much like something coming from military brass, coming from somebody in the Pentagon, and not enough of the emotional side of it. Even though you did bring your own younger brother in, that part of it I agree with. But how we actually go to war against radical Islam cannot be dealt with until we can define the difference between radical Islam and the rest of the Islam. Mm-hmm. Now, the analogy you used was communism and Nazism. We don't talk about radical Nazism versus moderate Nazism or radical communism versus moderate communism. Now, we have a lot of guests coming on Coast to Coast who tell us that just by demographics alone, Islam is going to be a problem for us. They tell us that France is going to eventually be dominated by Islam just on the basis of the birth situation there. The regular French aren't producing enough children, and the Islamic people are growing like wildfire. So if we're going to go to war with an ideology that has a worldview and a population expansion plan that beats everything that's going out here in Christianity and everything else, how are we going to go about that war? We can't just do it by putting troops on the border.
Well, you make some excellent points, and I think you have to separate some of those issues that you're talking about. You're talking about population versus radical Islam, and those are two different scenarios. I think you can make comparisons to communism versus systems like socialism. The next step beyond socialism, I believe, was communism, and it's the same with benign Islam versus radical Islam. Mm-hmm. It's a cult of personalities. People who take the idea of Islam and take it to a next level, which is more personal, political, social, economic. It has nothing to do with the basic religion. It has to do with their own station in life, with their own personal situation. And I think that's where the bastardization comes from. And I think in a military sense, I think that's a completely different direction for the U.S. military. But I think that's a mission that I think the U.S. military can accept, and I think that they have to be allowed to do that mission, and they have to go after those who have taken the religion of Islam and then corrupted it and made it into an enemy force that is completely different than what we faced in the past. We're not facing anyone who has a flag, who has a uniform, who has a nation. It's a pan national system that we have to be willing to cross borders, cross social, economic, religious borders to be able to fight, and that's a problem for Americans. We don't want to be known as a people who will go after people. Not just people who would attack us, who would oppose us like 9/11, but who would just oppose an idea, or who would oppose religion. It's a completely different direction that I think the U.S. military has to undertake.
And it's going to be a very, very, very difficult one, as PC as we are. Yikes. Will in California, you're on the air with Dale Brown. Hi.
Hello, Mr. Brown. You said that Iraq is the center of our strategy against radical Islam, but you admit that really radical Islam was not operating there until we invaded. And I'd like you to take a look at how truly radical an idea it is for us to go to that nation, which was not a threat to us and had not attacked us, and turn that nation into a war zone, and 4 years later still be there with no end in sight. And our very radical act of waging this war has killed or injured over 1 million people. Now, that is radical. That is radical.
Well, I disagree with the million people, first of all. But
killed or injured.
First of all, we were in conflict with Iraq. They were. Saddam Hussein was a sworn enemy of the United States.
Many nations have bad guys as their leaders, including ours.
Yes, but after 9/11, after we recognized after 9/11 that the enemy was radical Islam, and we realized that the enemy wasn't necessarily in Iraq, but the enemy that we were facing was a pan-national enemy.
Let's just focus
was
on
being
9/11
supported.
For a minute.
Well, wait a minute now. It was an enemy being supported by nations that were...
But not Iraq.
Right, not Iraq, but Saudi Arabia, countries that...
Why didn't we invade Saudi Arabia then?
Well, I mean, for obvious reasons, because Saudi Arabia is a major supplier of oil for the United States, and we couldn't go after them. I mean, and that's realistic. I mean, everybody has to recognize and realize that we couldn't take down the government of Saudi Arabia because we get 40% of our Middle East oil from Saudi Arabia. That's the reality of the situation. I mean, we couldn't take down Bahrain. We couldn't take down the United Arab Emirates, even though that they were supporting elements of Al Qaeda. We were enemies with Saddam Hussein. Iraq was an enemy of the United States. They did support terrorism. They may not have been supporters of Al Qaeda, but they were supporters of terrorism. And so we had a no-fly zone. We had jets flying every day over two-thirds of Iraq. I mean, so there was a thorn in the side of the United States for over 10 years after the 1991 war.
And being absolutely honest, we needed a military strategic location like Iraq. We needed
bases where we didn't have to rely on political problems to be able to operate. Even Saudi Arabia was a problem. As an offshoot of Al Qaeda, of its effect against the Saudi regime, we realized that we couldn't rely on Saudi Arabia to support the United States, even after 9/11. We couldn't rely on allies like Saudi Arabia to support the United States going after Al Qaeda because Al Qaeda was such a threat against the monarchy in Saudi Arabia. We have to have bases in the Middle East where we didn't have to worry about political problems like with Saudi Arabia. We have to have a presence in the Middle East that we wouldn't have to worry about other external problems like that. Iraq was the perfect solution. There's only one reason why we have 2,000 tanks and armored vehicles in Iraq. I mean, not just to take Baghdad, not just to bring down Saddam Hussein, but to threaten all the other regimes in the region.
Somebody right in your hometown, Lake Tahoe. Mark, you're on the air with Dale Brown.
Good evening, Art. Long, long, long time listener. Thank you for improving the nighttime.
You bet.
Really enjoyed Mr. Brown tonight. I'm glad to hear somebody actually state what the facts are. I'm going to ask for a slightly sharper point on the pencil vis-a-vis our immediate enemy being radical Sunnis and their desire to return the caliphate system, and whether, if that were to occur, we could depend on that force going up against the Shias. A quick second question, just the concern of silkworm missiles from Iran as we try to pass ships through the Straits of Hormuz?
Well, second question first. That's a major consideration, and I'll bet, from doing research for Shadows of Steel, my eighth novel, that the United States has specific targets, specific packages in mind to take out Abu Musa Island, other areas in Iran that have the Silkworm missiles, and I'll bet Israel has probably three times the plans in place to take out. That's a major threat for everybody. They're Chinese supplied missiles. They're very effective. They're not supersonic, but they're very high powered missiles that could easily take out oil tankers, and in the Straits of Hormuz, that relatively narrow waterway, that's a major consideration for everyone. Mm-hmm. If we're going to attack Iran, the major problem is not taking out the nuclear facilities, not taking out their research and development facilities, not taking out the centrifuges, but dealing with those Silkworm missile bases, dealing with the air defense bases, things like that. As far as the conflict between the Sunnis and the Shiites, mm-hmm. it's a long-term problem that I don't think most Americans can deal with. As a military problem, you really can't confuse the issue so much. Is Iran Shiite, Sunni, can we rely on the Sunnis in the world, in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan, in the United Arab Emirates, to support the United States against the Shiites? So we can't be concerned with things like that. We have to focus in on military targets, military objectives, and that's what I try to do in Strike Force. That's what I'll do in future books.
All right, Dale, listen, we're out of time. Show's over. It just flew by.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you again.
It really has been a pleasure talking with you. Dale, we're going to do it again one day.
I'd love to.
There are so much we could do. Take care, my friend, and have a great night.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure being with you.
It was a pleasure being with you, too. Dale Brown, ladies and gentlemen, one of my favorite authors, no question about it. If you haven't read Dale Brown, get busy. He's got good stuff. From the High Desert, I'm Art Bell. See you tomorrow night. Good night.